Thank you, Maggie. Thanks for joining us. Hi, John and Ellen and Paul for joining us. We'll talk for about half an hour, and then at about 1:30, we'll open it up and people can call in or type in comments or questions. So here's the context why I'm excited about what Paul and Ellen are doing. That there's great conversation in this world about healthcare reform. And if you look at most of it, it's really about better disease management, better healthcare management. Most of it is about how to automate the process, how to lower the cost, increase speed, make it more convenient. And to me, that's not really reform. And I thought it was until I met Paul several years ago. And what Paul represents to me, the real reform was to change my relationship with my own health and with the healthcare professional. And what's exciting about what Paul has done is he and Ellen have innovated something in the relationship we have with our own health and the people around us, and treat health as a social phenomenon, not a medical problem to be solved. So I'm excited, Paul. I don't quite know where you'd like to begin. You both and Ellen have written a book. Maybe you could, just for people who aren't familiar with your work and your thinking, give us a little introduction about kind of what's exciting to you now about what you're in the process of writing about and creating.
Well, Peter, this is Paul, and let me just begin by thanking you and John and Maggie and Leslie and the listening, participating audience for the privilege of having the two of us with you today. I've long been an admirer of your work, and the audience may or may not know, but you and I had an opportunity to cross paths in Cincinnati several years ago and to sort of work side by side a little bit in healthcare. And it was just a really tremendous experience, and I'm so grateful for our continued friendship. Ellen and I bring complementary perspectives, and I'll let her begin from this point of view. Ellen, could I pass on to you?
Yes, hi, and again, thank you for having us here. I met Paul in a culture workshop after he had done some wonderful things in a hospital, and the culture, he said, chewed him up and spit him out. He said, if we could figure that out. And really what he was talking about in the end was building community in the hospital, right, and what that means. And I like the way Peter put it there, that this is a social phenomenon that was going on. So that was 10 years ago. We never stopped talking and thinking about how do we build a healing environment where people can relate in new ways. And turns out that relating in new ways is the way that you create new ways of relating. So it's been a fun journey. So, Paul?
The work that we're focusing on is in hospitals. And I guess I'd just say right from the very beginning that the interaction in a hospital is only a very small part of where health is created as we live and work together. That's true for health in general. It's also true for the way that we respond and recover and heal from an episode of illness. And yet, an entire lifetime can be lived in those few days of a hospital stay for someone who is seriously ill, and their families and the people who are working together to care for them. What's very interesting to me, and sort of the framing a little bit of our book, is a transformation that's occurring. I think it's not limited only to healthcare. I think it's a much deeper transformation in society. But I've certainly been a party to that in the years of my career in healthcare. We all know every day the conversations that are happening in our country about health reform. And I don't really have a lot of deep passion about that one way or the other, whether we're a Democrat or Republican, or what we think of the health reform legislation is smaller on my kind of concerns, then to step back a little bit and look at some very broad changes that are happening in healthcare. I'm a physician. I was trained very well to do the things that I do. It's interesting to step back and look at that training and the work that that physicians, nurses, social workers, pharmacists, all the health professions, what we do and how we're trained. And there's basically a model that we work under. It's a model that tends to, certainly in my professional medicine, to abstract the person away, to focus on the disease, to focus on the scientific treatment of that. And that's wonderful. I don't want to take anything away from that. But along the way, as that model has been applied for decades now, some things, really important things, have become sort of off-center or lost. And it's interesting to just reflect about kind of the trajectory of this way of working in healthcare. When we step back and we look at healthcare, we see and a huge part of our society, with some of the very finest people that society has, were very well trained, very responsible, working very hard every day across the country and, in fact, across the world. And yet, when we step back and see the results of that in terms of costs that are growing at unsustainable rates, quality that is surprisingly uneven and not what we wish it would be, people that we really cannot open the doors of healthcare to in the way that all of us would wish that we could, and the experiences of giving and receiving care, something that should be one of the most extraordinary of human interactions, often leaving people feeling alienated, exhausted, discouraged, scared, instead of restored and renewed. And so really my journey kind of almost began by trying to understand, how can this be that such good people working so hard can produce such less than optimum results for society? And as I began to understand this, it really was fascinating to sort of learn the history of these models that we work in. They really have a birth date in the late 1800s and a place, actually, the Johns Hopkins Medical School, which was founded in 1893. And there was a small core faculty of really radical, revolutionary pioneers that came together at that time, and they basically birthed this model of care. There was another really powerful event in the history, which occurred in 1910, when Abraham Flexner studied the state of education and practice in the United States in healthcare, and he wrote a very scathing report, and the world was ready for that. He said, you know, there's just so much that needs to be done better, but there's a model. There's this Hopkins model. And there was a crystallization not only in United States practice, but across the entire world, around these ways of working, the ways that hospitals are organized, the way that practitioners do their work, the underlying thought processes and resources that are used to try to help people in times of need. And we had 50 or 75 years of amazing benefits from that. My own specialty is one of those, of cardiothoracic surgery, which did not exist at that time. And was born and matured, and there's so many things that can be done for people. And yet, increasingly, those ways of working no longer are bringing us benefits, that we've outgrown them. We have extended capabilities and begun to fractionalize what we do so much that the human core of the process is often lost. And with that, just tremendous opportunities have arisen for trying to do things in new ways. So our work is really about pathways to a new future. I'm increasingly certain that we're at a fascinating time in healthcare, a once in 100 or 120 year moment where a paradigm is being completely rewritten. One of those early pioneers so long ago was a very revered figure in healthcare. His name is William Osler. And he gave an address, a commencement address, in about 1916 to a medical school class. And it was a very poignant thing to discover this and read it. It was called to my attention as I heard a talk by a person I admire very much named Brent James, who is a real pioneer in transforming healthcare practice in the Salt Lake City area. And he found this talk, and it's incredible. Osler begins by saying, you know, congratulations, you're at such a milestone in your life, you're about to go into your practice, and you're going to do extraordinary things, and you're going to have wonderful lives. And then he paused and said, but you know, actually, I feel sorry for you, because you will never be able to experience the unbelievable thrills, the highs and lows of creating a new way of working in healthcare, as we did. And this transformation had nearly finished by the time that he gave this talk. And it was so poignant because for decades after that, he would have had to give that same talk, but not today. Today, he would probably be there with his bright eyes and saying, it's come back again. It falls to your generations to create this new world of healthcare. And that's what I really feel, that we're at this moment. Now, like all true innovations, what this future is going to be, we don't fully see it yet. But the pathways we can see. And absolutely. And what I was going to say is those pathways are through collaborative practice and active engagement of patients and families.
Yeah, could you make it more concrete for us and give us some examples of the transformation?
Sure. Let's think about my friend Mary. Mary is a nursing educator. She's a maternal child nurse. About 13 years ago, her mother was and father were in a terrible car accident. They were going out to dinner with another couple, and there was another driver who collided with them head on. The two friends of the family were killed at the scene. Her mother was very seriously injured with a head injury. Her father, who she said was the least healthy, was actually the least injured. And over the next 30-some days, Mary and her family helped care for her mother in what proved to be the last month of her mother's life. The challenges that she encountered in the interactions began when she first came to the hospital. She was notified by her parents' pastor that the accident had happened. And she was there at the emergency room as a nurse, as a daughter, and could not even be allowed into the room to see her mother because they had not positively identified her mother, even though she said, that is my mother. It took a phone call to the sheriff to release the names that finally allowed her to even come in. Over the next month, her mother was transferred 5 different times. She spoke to multiple people who were trying very hard, working very well, trying to care for her mother. And yet, she said with each transfer, little bits of her mother's history was lost. She said if she were not there, the ability to communicate and connect between what one group thought and another group thought, or even from one shift to another shift, was completely missing. Eventually, her mother died. Probably her mother would have died anyway, but Mary was just grieving the fractionated care that she experienced and the kind of the way that the entire thing took place. She talked about her father. She said her father was an older man in a wheelchair. A niece brought him 50 miles each day to spend time with her mother. And when healthcare practitioners would come in, they would ignore him. They wouldn't speak with him. They would talk to her because she was a nurse. She said the language went up a notch. She said, please don't ever forget that this person's here. These are often, sadly, the realities that people experience in healthcare and hospitals. There is wonderful intent and so many people working so well, and yet often this disconnectedness. Sometimes people say, don't you people talk to each other? And so we set out trying to say, how could we do better? How could we do an even better job of doing this? And it turned out to be the simplest things, simply trying to bring people together to use ordinary language, to sit down, to sort of change these traditional hierarchies so that the strengths of the patient and family were woven into the care that we were giving. And as we began working in these ways, things started to change. Outcomes started to improve. Patient satisfaction started to change. Our sense of meaning and fulfillment started to change. And also the context that we were creating became sort of alien in the hospital system, and that created interesting challenges as well. Eventually, several of these very successful models that we've created have not survived in their organizational context. And so what Ellen and I have been working on for the last 10 years is sort of an explication of what's really happening. We call it an implementation field guide for people that wish to kind of follow on this journey and make their own contributions. And there's some kind of some concepts that we've been able to develop and apply that I think might have some meaning outside of healthcare as well. I'm concerned that I'm talking too much about this, so I'm going to just be quiet and listen here for a minute, Peter.
Well, that starts to make it concrete. Ellen, would you like to add something to help us get more of the texture of the, like what it looks like?
Right. Yeah. No. I think these pathways, you know, is a good way to think about that. That we are, and it's not specific to healthcare. We are, as a universe, moving from the ideas of having experts to the ideas of doing things collective and in collaborative ways. And the healthcare environment itself has been organized around individual providers and sort of the power and respect that we give to that way of organizing the work. And it's moving now to involving the patient and the family, and this is not a new discourse in our society. We want that for our family. We want that to organize around that. And furthermore, to organize, and what we're focusing on is organizing around meaning. And when you start doing that, when you start putting people in the same room together and you ask each other what matters to you, you have a whole different context. And so what we're talking about here is building what we're calling a social field that is full and rich of resources that enable us to do things that you can't do when you organize a different way. So you can ask each other, how can we get this guy to his sister's wedding? We know he's going to die. He's going to be dead in a month. But what he wants is to get to his sister's wedding before that happens. How can we do that, right? And so that way of thinking about what care is and what help is, you know, puts you on a different agenda as you're together. And so what we're looking at is that sort of reflexiveness between the patterns of interactions that we can build intentionally that don't naturally happen in a hospital. And, you know, for those of you on the call, and we've got to figure out who you are, you know that the meetings happen by profession or maybe not at all. What would happen if we put different people in the room together?
What would I see, Ellen?
Yeah, so right now, some hospitals you walk in, what you see is a conference room down at the end of the hall where, a group of people are talking about the patient. If you take that group of people and you put them in the patient's room with the family, they're talking with the patient, right, and with the family. And furthermore, you invite them. You say, and what can you tell us about what's important to your father? What can you tell us about what his life is like, you know, when he gets home? What can you tell us? And can we all get clear about what that means here today, this only part? And, you know, how can we so there is that standing where you're standing in the hospital, the things that we can do to change, again, how the care happens, and it opens up. You know, it makes possible the ability for us to say things to each other that we didn't before.
I would see people standing in a circle in a hospital room, a patient's room.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Who would be in that circle?
Well, you know, the interdisciplinary, what we call the multidisciplinary rounds, is something that's also emerging, and there's something to be said beyond that. I mean, all the disciplines would be there. Imagine a pharmacist and a, because remember the driving question was, do you guys talk, right? So, because if you've had this experience of being in the bed in a hospital, and the nurse comes by, and then the doctor comes by, and then the probably pharmacist never comes by, the resident comes by, and maybe you get a little bit of the story from each one, but who's integrating that? So the first thing that happens is that sort of opportunity for everybody to be there. But the thing that really happens is the emergence of something that wasn't there before, because you can create with all of that content in the room and all of that feeling of like, wow, you know, this is it becomes sort of a magical circle where people look at each other and this patient says, all of you care about me? I had no idea that all these people were caring for me. And it's, you know, there's this fondness that shows up between the patient and the family. And so, I mean, and then it becomes a healing circle. It's not about the medicine anymore. It's not about the disease. So the shift from the traditional care model, which, you know, as Paul pointed out, has great benefit, you know, but diagnosing and talking about the body parts, you know, we have a heart in bed too, right? That's the way it gets talked about, right? And now we can say we have Mr. James and his wife over here. Let's go and visit together and see what, you know, what we need to do today, and this is what we did, you know, the promises that we made, the promises that we kept to each other. There's a whole different language that comes with that way of caring for each other.
One of the interesting things, Peter, is our marker of whether this is working or not is whether there's laughter. There's this kind of leveling where we're just sort of people together. There's an interesting term called patient-centered care. And we began to notice that really the patient wasn't in the center of this circle. The patient was a part of this circle. The patient, the family, all of us, and all of us are just contributing whatever expertise we can. The patient's contributing their sense of what they really want and need. The family's contributing. We're contributing different things. And somehow we're kind of providing for each other's care. And there is this very beautiful thing that takes place. It's amazing.
John, any thoughts or questions you might have that might peep in the conversation?
One thing I was wondering, whether both of you had examples. Here we're trying to get engaged in the process, the patient and the family and relatives. Can you give us some examples of what their participation, the content of their participation, has meant in terms of your ability to do your job? You're listening to people who usually aren't listened to, and you are a person with some expertise in diagnosis and treatment. What do you learn that you never learned before because they're in the discussion?
You learn the things that matter. The shift comes toward meaning. One of the patients that I can remember, all he wanted to do was to get home to his mule. He had one horse and one mule. And that was more important to him than any of my, you know, medicine. If you can just get me home to this, that matters. Another gentleman raised black diamond watermelons. I'd never known what a black diamond watermelon was. Another man was an airline pilot, and he was interpreting everything that was happening through the lens of, am I still going to be able to fly? So there's sort of like what matters to us in our lives. Uh-huh. And then there's this sort of inconvenience of this thing that's just happened, like this heart attack. There are probably many different ways to respond, but if you were to create a polarity, one way is to respond to the heart attack and to sort of assume that our job is to fix the heart attack, and then they can kind of go about their life. And that's what healthcare is often like. And a different way is to sort of say, okay, what are our true goals here? What is this person finding meaning in? And how can we weave the care that we are co-creating together in such a way that it supports the richness of those goals, and it's very different.
Yeah.
That's
and
a wonderful
thinking, you know,
way.
You're saying, you know, you're talking about the hearts being broken, but there's also broken hearts. And I hear lots of stories from Paul. That's sort of what I do, is asking for his stories every day. And one recently was some brothers. Their mother was very, very sick and wasn't going to make, and they hadn't spoken in years. And so it was a broken family, really. And here you were at this moment when they knew that it would be better for their mother for them to stand together by her bedside and be together. And Paul was able to facilitate that, you know, as a human being, you know, with these brothers who really wanted the right to relate in new ways, right, at the bedside where their mother was. And, you know, as a society, we can ask ourselves, why are we dying in the hospital in the first place? There's a whole, you know, other sets of conversations we could be having here. But today, while it's still happening, while we're still handing that ritual over to the hospitals, then providers are in that place of really important moments in our social lives when our parents are dying. And so to be able to be human with each other, I think, is a resource that you can build together. And you know, we say these are the things that it makes sense. We can do that here now. We should do that. We ought to do that with each other. And that's what we're looking for when we're going in. It's what people think they ought to be doing here with each other. You ought to just be giving my medicine and leave? Or is there something else?
Yeah.
You know, if I could add one other dimension, just as a member of a care team, we've spent a lot of time on the call so far talking about the rounds itself and the interaction and the purposes. What we found was that when we tried to simply enact rounds in a collaborative way, that it almost always did not sustain in the care environment. And when we went back and looked at the places where it did work, what we saw was that in addition to the rounds, there was in some way another element that had arisen in that environment, which was a weekly meeting of the care team, ideally with patient and family presence as well, but not for the purpose of caring for individual patients, but to just simply give us an opportunity to reflect, how are we doing together as a team? And a whole lot of the book has to do with the importance of creating, we coined a term that we call relational infrastructure. And it connects with this idea of action and reflection being coupled together. In healthcare, there is tons of action, and there is almost no opportunities for the intact collective team to reflect together about their work as a team and how they can do an even better job. And by our implementation model is actually, it centers on creating opportunities for people to simply meet, reflect, and converse. And what we find is that builds this social field, this capacity that is increasingly rich with what we call resources, contextual resources that arise in that. We've done this together before. We can draw on that the next time we do it. We remember this family. And that way we can respond even more empathetically and wisely with this family. These become resources that we draw upon, but it's enabled by this infrastructure. And in healthcare, those things just usually don't exist. And so the implementation model really focuses on how things are created in conversation.
What's the argument against this, Paul or Ellen?
Well, so part of the relational infrastructure is saying things like, we need to schedule the way that we work so that we all can be together, and that's not the way we're organized. Very often, as you know, the physicians are not even employed by the hospitals, so just that, how can we ever come together? You know, it's really hard. And then
that's nice, but we're too busy for that. I mean, like, give me a break.
Yeah. And anyway, you know, why would he do that? You know, a real surgeon would be in the OR. You know, why are you out here, you know, on the floor with the family? The nurses do that part, right? So there, we have a divide and conquer way of scheduling and organizing and paying and all of the other, you know, we call this OD 101, right?
Right.
it's shocking how simple the idea is and how hard it is to implement. Because, and here's a really great example. We were just at a teaching hospital where the residents are at the bedside, and you know what's happening? What they're doing with those rounds is they're teaching. They are teaching, and it's not that they don't care, and it's not that they're not giving good care to the patient, but what they're actually doing is teaching. And so when you ask them to move to this way of talking so that the conversation is divided, you know, among the people who are in the room, the attending says, now, wait a minute, how am I supposed to grade, basically, you know, the resident on his knowledge and his ability to report if I don't, if he's not doing that, right, if he's not reporting out at the bedside, right? And that's a different accomplishment. That's a different priority. And so it's a very real question. How do you stay in the institutions that are built around creating these magnificent professions that keep us alive more and more? And we want that. We want that as a society. We want medicine to save us, right? But how do we do that and create these healing environments at the same time?
Well, let me ask one more question,
sure,
if I can. I want to open it up and see if people would like to call in. Is there any? What about when they leave the hospital, leave the director? Any mm-hmm. any thoughts or things you're thinking about that would sustain the kind of healing environment afterwards?
Yeah, I had this wonderful man come to the door the other day selling magazines. He's had a really rough life, and he's trying to get back on his feet. And he learned that I work with the Ronald McDonald House, which is about, you know, putting families at the bedside. And he said, oh, can I bring my son who's like 5, can I bring my son and show him, I want to take him to this because I want to show him how to take care of people. Because he had been in that situation and he knew that his family didn't know how to take care of him, and he was left with these, you know, providers to do it because he said his mother is on drugs and he doesn't know how to help her. He doesn't know how to take care of her. I want him to learn that. And I just thought, oh my gosh, where do we teach our children how to care for each other? Where do we teach them how to, you know? So I think there are some answers at a lot of different levels. Peter, there's these help desks coming in to help connect to community-based organizations that are standing there wanting to help from all of our institutions, when people come out of prisons, when they come out of hospitals, when they come out, you know. But out of college now, right? I mean, how do we help each other make these transitions? But I think that was so touching to me, where this man wanted to teach his son to take care of his mother.
I guess,
well,
let
me just pause, and because we're about to, we've got about half an hour.
Sure.
Maybe, Maggie, you could invite people in to see if they want to either have a chat space or call in.
Sure. We would love to have you participate. So you can do that by pressing *8 on your telephone, and you will be put into a queue and be able to participate in the call. Or you can type something in the chat. We do have a couple of comments in the chat, and I just had a caller come in. So the comments were in the chat were early in Paul's discussion, and one question was, and I'll give you both at the same time, is it true for geriatric community too? And the other one was, human core is lost, please explain. And then, as I mentioned, we do have one caller in the queue.
So I think they may have responded to some of that. There's another call that says, my client is a group of facilities for senior living, independent assisted skilled nursing dementia unit. What would it be like? Now, maybe we should take the call and then we'll kind of lump these together and let Ellen and Paul respond.
Okay.
Caller, you want to call? Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. So we'll take the call. And this is from West Tennessee.
Yeah. All right.
Hello?
Hello. This is Dr. Art Sutherland. I'm a retired cardiologist, and I've been working in population health issues for the last 10 years. I understand all about hospitals, but the thing I want to point out is that basically that's really extreme care, end of life, extreme trauma, extreme diseases. And what you're doing is fantastic in that setting. But I was thinking and hoping to hear that if we're talking about the abundant community, that we really need to focus on the community, because medicine only accounts for about 10 to 20% of the wellness of the whole country. And if we do the upstream approach and eliminate the social determinants of health, make them better so that they aren't all negative, then you'll do a much better job at prevention, and you'll keep people from reaching these terrible end stages, prematurely.
Art, thank you. This is Paul. And Ellen, did you want to start, and then I'll add a few comments?
I said I hope so, you know, and this goes back to, you know, what we teach our children. You know, this movement is not, as you say, about the hospital and only about the hospital. In fact, we hope that it becomes less so, right? It is about how we help each other before we get there and after we leave there. I'm with you. I think that it was Herb Shepherd that said, you know, light many fires, right, and get all the people involved and continue to ask that question, who should be in this conversation.
This is a really poignant and important question that he asks. And there is a fascinating literature about what's called social determinants of health that shows what's done in acute healthcare is just a tiny fraction of the determinant of the health of a population. This actually led about 5 years ago for me to almost a crisis of faith almost. It's like I've been spending my entire life trying to make care better in a hospital setting, and it became increasingly clear to me that where our health is really truly created and where the work needs to happen is in the community. And so it's like, oh my gosh, what am I doing and why am I doing this? And it then gradually became clear to me that what I had in the hospital setting was an extraordinary laboratory for understanding how to achieve things that could apply in many different settings. And the way that we view what we're doing now is that we're basically in that hospital care unit, which let's now imagine could be a workplace or a school or any community setting, we were actually creating what we would call an intentional alternative social field. And we were developing methodologies to generate this richness of resources in this intentionally generated social field that would allow people to almost effortlessly do things that if we tried to do it by individual coordination or hard effort, were almost impossible. The simple ideas of that there is this thing called a social field that kind of is this living memory bubble of things that people have done together, that there are these resources in that which are shared experiences, memories, previous interactions, that these are actually made or socially constructed by people doing things together. That if you don't have a way to meet and connect and interact, that these things cannot form. And that by intentionally creating those things, simply in our case, a weekly meeting of the interprofessional team with patients and families that have been cared for before present, so that voice is there as well. Opportunities for action and reflection, so that you're always moving into action and then back to reflection and then back to action and then back to reflection, that it grows and populates the social field with these amazing capabilities. And so as we begin, yes.
Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I didn't know, Maggie, if there's anybody else wanting to call in.
No other callers just yet, Peter.
Okay. One of the questions, are there any places doing this intentional alternative social field? I want to mention that EpiCon and the time banking idea has created a structure to build, I think, the kind of social field, the way of people exchanging and engaging in a kind of an economy of generosity. So, I think there are some structures out there. and this is called time banking, that I think, you know, we've had that here on the call other times. So there are some things happening.
Edgar's comments are concepts are very exciting. The idea of giving that structure so that things that people want to give and take great meaning in giving, and people that people wish to receive and interact with can connect. And it's very exciting to me.
Yeah, someone asked here, what are the building blocks? And I would say connection is the word you're hearing over and over here.
Yeah.
You know, to structure opportunities where people can connect, the magic will happen, right? I mean, give them that opportunity to pay attention to each other in ways that they've not had the opportunity to do in our, you know, the way we're walking through life right now, you know, so change our pathways so that we're walking in a way that's more connected and that we have these moments to stop. And that can happen in the community, maybe even easier than the hospital, and that would be awesome.
Yeah. This is John. I might add that there is a community organizing movement, neighborhood organizing movement, that is increasingly focused on how do we weave people together around what they have or want to contribute rather than what they want to fix or change. And when you see what begins to emerge in those neighborhoods, it seems to me what you find is a bridge to the kind of in-institution experiment that you have. Supposing you knew from a neighborhood around the hospital that there were 16 people who indicated they would like to do this with people who were older, or that they would like to provide the following kinds of interactions with people who loved horses, you know. So as we move toward a culture of a contributing, productive, giving community, it provides the information that people within institutions need, I would say, but can use in terms of answering sort of Peter's question, when somebody leaves here, where does this continue? What
right.
do you build on? So connecting that kind of organizing with what you're doing has great potential.
Yeah, and who does that connecting, right? Who's responsible for it? And that's the gap that we saw here in the San Francisco Bay Area is, you know, when you get discharged, who's standing there, right? And when the doctor sees, when the pediatrician sees, this child is hungry, you know, I'd like to work with the disease, but this child has lead in their apartment, this child, and there are community-based organizations out there that can do something about that, but who is it that makes that connection between the need of the family and the organizations and people, as you say, the individuals who are standing there going, I'd like to help. I'd like to show you how to ride horses, right? And it's that organizing around that that's not robust yet. And we're
right.
working on that in different ways.
Here's a question somebody wrote in. Why do not doctors leave the place of the clinic or hospital and join the social context of the patient? Interesting question.
So, but I mean, it's a serious question. So ask it again. Let me just think about it for a minute.
Yes.
Why do not doctors leave the place of the clinic or hospital and join the social context of the patient?
I will tell stories about Paul where he has done that, and he has been scorned by his hospital system for doing it, and that makes me angry. But it happens because, you know, legally you can't go to that guy's house and see how he's doing, right? And,
yeah, really. Well, you can. But they I was discouraged from doing that in several cases. But I do it, I love that. Yes, and it increasingly, you know, it that way of working works. And it's going to be harder at first to get doctors to do that, but there are wonderful other health professionals who live in those worlds. And gradually, the more that physicians are able to experience that, and that brings up kind of the whole domain of health professions education, but it is it's extraordinary how transformative that is. So it's a wonderful question. And the more that we can do those things, the better we get. I want to go
back
to...
And why don't we stop relying on doctors? You know, maybe there are other people out there, or other professions out there that can... Why does it have to be only the doctor? We just said that we need a whole team here. We need a whole village. So if we stop asking for the doctor to come to the... What if we ask a different question? You know, how can we create a healing circle that is funded differently, right, resourced differently? Than expecting the doctors who are in this system to do that. And I don't know that that's the right answer. Maybe we need them. I'm just saying that there's more than one way to think about what's happening there.
And that's how this hospice movement really began before it became medicalized.
Mm-hmm.
It was exactly what you're talking about.
And we do have another call in the queue.
Great.
So I'll go ahead and take that.
Okay, am I online?
Okay, hello.
Yes. Hello, are you, can you hear me?
We can.
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, good. Hi, this is Charlie Hathorn. I'm calling from Arizona, and I'm the one that brought up the question about senior living. I've got a client, and in terms of the strategic work they're doing, it's like a culture shift from moving from going to a place to die to going to a place to live. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's a sort of a real major turning things upside down. It has an implication for, I guess in Peter's word, it's hospitality, you know, and in terms of coming to a place to live. And as I listen to you, it's the idea of now, how can we think about creating such senior living places as a place of community. What mm-hmm. I've heard Paul and Ellen talk about in terms of the hospital setting is really reintroducing existential issues that the community helps us address, you know, like the denial of death and what choices do I have and meaning and isolation and all of those kinds of things that I'm hearing going mm-hmm. around the hospital bed or in the hospital room seem to be reintroductions of a human element that maybe we could think about in terms of senior living facilities. And that's just the thoughts I'm having. I'd love to hear your reaction to that.
I would take human element and say human spirit. One of the questions that we ask is, is the thing that we're suggesting and doing here helping the human spirit or hurting the human spirit? And I think that's possible no matter where you're standing. And I love that, building the place of living and that, and just can see the possibilities for the connectedness there when it's alive like that, when that's what you're feeding.
Thanks. So we're kind of running near the end. Final thoughts or Paul and Ellen that you would like to share with us as a kind of even your thoughts about this call and how it's gone for you?
Ellen?
Oh, thank you for being here. I'm a little disappointed we didn't hear from everybody on the call. I see there are 26 people. We didn't hear their voices, but thank you for being here, and we hope we can connect.
Thanks, Paul. Ellen. And from my perspective, what I know is that I have been changed by these interactions at the bedside of patients in these ways. And I know that my colleagues have, and I know that the patients and families have as well. And your question, Peter, how does this carry forth from the hospital into the community? I think that at least one way is that it carries forth in that we leave these conversations with a different heart. We see things in new ways. We see possibilities that we didn't see before. We have kind of a confidence that we actually can participate in our own care, that we can work in different ways, that care doesn't have to be produced and consumed, but that it can be co-created together, that it's really not just about whether an illness is treated, but whether a life of, you know, kind of purpose and wholeness is recognized and shared with others. And so I think it's that change that takes place as we participate in these things that is the thing that carries it forward. So I am glad for this chance to have yet another conversation. And that's been the thing that's been so fascinating for me as a doctor is to see the power of simply talking and mm-hmm. creating safe places where that can take place. So those would be my few reflections here right now.
That's a great point, Paul. Well, thank you, Paul, and to Ellen. Thank you very much. Nice to hear your voice in what we're doing here. I appreciate that. John, any final thought you might have, and then we'll give it back to Maggie.
Yeah. It does strike me that something that Paul and Ellen are moving toward is applicable across fields is they are redefining what it is to be a professional. And I think for many, many professions across the health and human service world, we're always cautioned about do not become involved with your patient. In Illinois, more medical people have lost their licenses for something called becoming personally involved with their patients than any other cause. But it is being personal that seems to me that is at the heart of what we're hearing here. And that contradicts one idea of what a professional is about. It threatens the idea of the objectivity of the person who is removed from us. So it's courageous, this redefinition, bringing into the world the personal as a critical factor in healing. It's a wonderful thing you're doing.
I also, my one thought is that I like, Paul, the way you keep saying that the science and the skill of the physician is very, very critical. There's nothing in what you're saying that undermines that or wants to substitute for that. And I think it's important that these two things, this kind of a social field you're talking about and the immense technical knowledge and skill that you have as a thoracic surgeon, those things can live together. It's not having to choose. It's not a movement from one to the other, but trying to deepen and enrich that. So I just appreciate always, every time I hear you, Paul, you start by saying what we've done is miraculous from a science and technical point of view. So thank you for that. So Maggie, let me give it back to you to complete this one.
Okay, great. Thanks. And I would just like to add my thanks to Paul and to Ellen for taking the time to be with us today and sharing your thinking, and also to thank our listeners. We hope you'll join us again on our next call, which is going to be April 1st, and we will have as our guest Janice Foster Richardson of Grassroots Grantmakers. And this call was recorded today and will be available on our website, so please visit us there at www.abundantcommunity.com and do stay in touch with us. So this will bring our program to a close today, and thank you so much for joining. See you next time.